Book Dreams, a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello, and welcome to Book Dreams, the podcast for everyone who loves books and misses English class. I'm Julie Sternberg, and I'm a children's book author.
And I'm Eve Yohalam. I'm also a children's book author. In each episode of this podcast, we consider a book-related topic. And in this episode, we consider, how does an author transform an old family legend into a transfixing novel that spans continents and generations?
The novel is China Room by Sanjeev Sahota. We got the idea for this episode because we kept seeing glowing reviews of it, saying, in essence, that it's an exquisitely written, sweeping family saga that's also a very manageable length. And to me, that is irresistible.
Oh my goodness, yes. You don't need to say anything more. And it's primarily set on a remote farm in India. So what's not to like?
Exactly.
China Room was longlisted for the 2021 Booker Prize and a finalist for the American Library Association's Carnegie Medal. We're so delighted that Sanjeev agreed to come on the podcast and talk with us about the family stories that inspired the book and the experiences from his life that made their way into it.
Sanjeev was named one of Granta's 20 Best of Young British Novelists of the Decade in 2013. In addition to China Room, he's the author of Ours Are the Streets, and The Year of the Runaways, which was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize and the Dylan Thomas Prize, and was awarded a European Union Prize for Literature.
Just a little bit more about China Room before we get started. It weaves together the stories of two family members separated by more than half a century. First, there's Meher, a young bride living on a farm in Punjab in 1929. She's trying to figure out which of three brothers is her new husband. Yeah, you heard that right. And that's the part that relates to the family legend. And then there's Meher's great-grandson 70 years later, who travels from England to that same farm where he struggles to overcome a heroin addiction. So we started our conversation with Sanjeev by asking him to share with us the family history that inspired China Room. Here's what he said.
There was a kind of a story, and it's a piece of family lore or legend that I've been hearing since I was quite a young boy or an adolescent. And I'd hear this when I went to India, which is a place I know very well, and I've still got a large family there. And I've been going annually since I was a child. But it went that a great-grandmother of mine was one of four young brides married to four brothers in a single ceremony. And none of the four brides knew which brother it was they were married to. Largely because they were kept sequestered from the men throughout the day, and there was a degree of having to be veiled as well. I should stress that how much of this story had been embellished over the decades, as family stories tend to be, I don't know, but the story was that it wasn't until a year later when they all saw which brother was holding which child that they finally worked out who was their husband. But that sounds, I'm not sure how much sort of family license has gone into that particular element of the story. Right, but yeah. That was kind of like the jokey story told with a great deal of levity down the years. I suppose the more I sort of thought about it, firstly, it just sounded like just such a shocking premise. It had kind of like a mythic, kind of looked like a fairy tale quality to it. These young brides in this room, not knowing who their husband was. But also, it just didn't seem like a quite a particularly humorous story to me. It sounded just quite a dark and painful story. That's one of the things that perhaps attracted me to it. So, and I think I was just really taken by that initial image of these young brides on this farm. And that farm, as I say, is a farm that still exists. It's in Punjab in Northwest India. It's my family's farm. I've spent, you know, many days and weeks there. And that room, the China room, as I call it in the novel, though it's not called the China room in real life, that room is still there. It's still got bars on it, and it's now used as a grain store. I mean, it's not as it was in the novel. In the novel, I've taken a degree of license in fictionalizing that story. But I suppose the existence of that room, this story, and this kind of this vague scandal of this another ancestor of mine around the same time being involved in the Indian independence movement, I think those three things were kind of the seeds of this novel.
Were there other things that you knew about your great-grandmother when she was young that helped to inform Mahar's story?
I knew she stayed in Punjab in the village pretty much all her life after she got married. And she only left Punjab once, and that was to come to England just a few months after I was born to see me. And that photo is in the book. She passed away a few months on from that photo, actually. So I'm quite lucky to have that photo as a kind of a memento of her.
Yeah. I loved seeing that photo reproduced in the book as well. It was very mind-blowing as a reader to think about this woman in the circumstances that you portrayed in 1920s rural India, and then to think of her kind of jet-setting, you know, off to England to hold this very modern boy who, you know, ends up playing a role as well in the book. I hear you saying now that she wasn't really jet-setting, but can you say a little about her circumstances in those early 1920s scenes?
Yeah, so in the novel, she's 15, she's a new bride. She's come to this farm on the outskirts of this village. She's one of three new brides, and she does form quite a sisterly relationship with her two sisters-in-law. And there's three brothers, and they're all sort of ruled by this quite tyrannical matriarch called Mai. And Meher in the novel, her days are very much spent working, you know, doing that domestic kind of drudgery, which I know women of the time did, and certainly my great-grandmother would have done that. She wouldn't have been more than 16, and she was married to one of several brothers, and she was living on a farm, and she would have been doing that kind of that milking, kind of that domestic kind of labor, which all women of that time had to do. And also, just like Mary, her name was also changed after she got married. No one knows what was the name that she was actually born with, because as was often the case, once girls got married, as part of that claiming ownership thing that went on, they were given their new name, which was called their real name.
You've also said something about mutual haunting going on between the two strands in the novel, Meher's 1920s story and her great-grandson's story. And that word mutual really caught me, because, you know, we can see how the past haunts the future. But in talking about mutual haunting, are you saying that it works the other way too, that somehow the great-grandson's story is haunting the past in some way?
I do think that, you know, in a society like India, which is so concerned with ideas of family and ideas of progeny and ideas of how the family name is going to carry on and lineage and heritage, and I think it's inevitable that people are always thinking about their children, their children's children, what's being passed down. I think it can be said that there is this reverb back from the great-grandson. I think he is in the minds of Meher and some of the other characters, that whatever they're going through isn't going to end here, it is going to live on in some way in their future offspring.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I love ideas about sort of the circularity of time rather than the linear concept of time.
Yeah.
I don't know that this is exactly what you were just saying, but made me think, you know, what happens to your great-grandchildren then affect in some way how you're remembered, right? Your reputation. It changes how you're seen, at least.
Reputation is so sort of intrinsic to how, especially the character in 1929, and even today in India, and even just in the Indian diaspora around the world, reputation and status counts for so much. It's like people can never quite be in the present because they're always thinking about how things are going to look further down the line.
I love this idea of the future haunting us, shaping our present and past. My worries about the future certainly affect what I choose to do now. And we say things like time will tell whether, for example, a particular president is considered great. But I had never really isolated that way of thinking about time before. Our conversation with Sanjeev also got me thinking about the identity of a spouse.
Ooh, wait, say more about that.
Yeah. So Meher's situation was extreme, right? She was heavily veiled and she was actually prevented from knowing which of the brothers was in fact her husband. She thought it was one and she was surprised to learn it was another. But we all experience this kind of thing to a certain extent if we stay married, I think. You know, Paul thought he was marrying a lawyer who could fall asleep any place, any time. Like sleeping was my superpower. And he ended up married to a children's book writer with a shoulder problem that keeps her up all night.
Right.
You know, I don't know
More than that, Julie.
That's all I feel like right now. Let's put it that way.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. I don't know whether Sanjeev intended China Room to be kind of an allegory for, all marriage and like wondering who you're married to, but it has elements of that for me.
Yeah. Well, please do not get me started on who Nick thought he was marrying all those years ago. I was 20 when we started dating. 20.
Wow.
Yeah. But to go back to what you were saying first, it does feel to me, the older I get, that time circles or maybe spirals around and around, sometimes forward, sometimes back. I don't know about you. I revisit parts of my life every time my children go through them. And then I carry that new version of my past with me until something triggers the next iteration.
Yeah.
Or I look ahead at my parents and at friends who are older than me, and I see myself where they are now. You know, I see future Eve where they are now. There's definitely a sense for me of different worlds all coexisting.
Ooh, and that notion of different worlds, that connects nicely to something that the author Brian Washington, who was also a former Book Dreams guest, said about China Room. We talked with Sanjeev about what Brian had to say. In his blurb for the book, Brian Washington praises the way that you navigate, and I'm going to quote now, the worlds between where we believe we belong, where we end up, and the choices that we make to close the distance along the way. I think that's such an interesting way to think about the characters and storylines in the book. Do you have any thoughts about it?
Other than I think I love Brian Washington.
He can blurb my book anytime.
Yeah, exactly.
What a great guy. I think of that in terms of the narrator, the great grandson, that where he, you know, he's born in England, he's grown up in the north of England. He feels like he should belong there, but of course he can't. You know, he's the only brown person living in his community in this very working class, quite deindustrialized, impoverished kind of like neighborhood he lives in. There's this constant sort of exclusion that he feels as a result of his race and his class as well. I think he's never felt like he can or is allowed to belong there. And then he goes to India and he does start to feel that, which is probably analogous to my relationship when I first started going to India, as I did feel just this great pull of acceptance, you know, to walk around a place where everyone, at least on the surface, looks like you, to not sort of always be, to not have your appearance always remarked upon, I think was just kind of an open and wonderful thing for the narrator to experience. And he does feel that sense of belonging in India. And of course, he meets various peak characters who kind of make him feel as if there's something special about this place that he's ended up, as well as aiding his recovery. It does seem to give him a sense of himself as well. So he thinks he should belong in England where he's grown up, but he doesn't. And he finds a sense of self and sense of belonging in India. But of course, that can't last. He just have to go back to UK and he has to navigate that gap. How does he come to some sort of reconciliation with who he is and where he is and where he has to go back to and how to make himself feel like he belongs there. And by the end of the novel, it's not quite clear that he's going to do that, because he relapses twice, recovers twice, a clear indication that it's a constant battle for him, this kind of sense of belonging and the suffering that kind of comes from not being allowed to belong.
That connects with my next question, which is, so you've said China Room is about the need for connection and how connection, along with ideas of home, is actually a form of loss because you can never really hold on to it. You're always just waiting for it to break. It's always contingent. That is a heartbreaking view of connection and home. And I'm wondering if you think it's universally true, or whether it's more true for some than for others.
I think it is more true for some than for others. I think being allowed to belong in a place is actually, it's quite a privileged thing. For example, like, I didn't feel like I particularly belonged when I was growing up in the UK, in the north of England, in the same kind of place that the narrator was growing up in the novel. And I think that's because I was a brown working class kid growing up in a predominantly, all of pretty much exclusively white working class area, and the difficulties that came with that. But I've noticed that the higher up I kind of, like, I go up the class ladder, you know, the more middle class I seem to become, the more sense of belonging I do feel. What's interesting to me that my children, who are growing up in a very different kind of place, they're growing up in a very middle class, quite a comfortable kind of, like, existence, and mixing with all sorts of different kids from all sorts of different backgrounds in their school, they seem to have a much more healthy relationship with England and with Englishness than I do. My children say that they're English, you know, when they're 6 years old, 8 years old, and I can't remember ever thinking or feeling or being able to sort of utter that kind of sentiment when I was their age. I think it's a great thing that they do, but it's not lost to me that that's because they are in a much more privileged position than I was. I don't think it's necessarily always to do with race either, or class. When I look at India and look at kind of the people that get called low caste in India, the Dalits, for example, and I wonder what sense of belonging do they really have in India, a place where they're always seen as being on the absolute bottom of the rung. If you're on the bottom of the rung, then you have no say in your position in society. So in India too, it feels like the people that are allowed to belong are people that are much more further up that social ladder.
I want to ask a related question, which is, you've told this story about your young son. You said, I was telling him some Punjabi words and he was like, why do I need to know this? And you said, because we hail from Punjab and it would be good for you to know these things about where you're from and where your grandparents are from. And he said, yeah, Dad, that's fine, but you do know I'm English, don't you? You said, I had to look away almost because it wasn't something you ever felt comfortable saying. Are there any circumstances under which you think you would become comfortable saying that?
Yeah, I mean, I looked away when he said that because I was so moved. Mm-hmm. I felt like, oh God, you actually do feel you have a sense of home here, you know, which is wonderful. And I do think it's because it's a question of class and the question of social mobility, perhaps. I lived in a shop my parents owned. We were the only sort of brown family. I was the only brown, me, myself, my brother were the only brown kids in our school. And it was a difficult school. I don't expect anyone to get the violins out here, but it was a challenging childhood. The manufacturing industry had just been so decimated. There was just a lot of unemployment, a lot of betrayal kind of just hung in the air. I just remember this abstract sense of betrayal continually in the air in a town where I grew up, these former miners who'd had their livelihoods taken away from them. And because the people that are to blame for that, which were the conservative government, weren't around, that psychological thing of displacement happens where you blame the other people that are near at hand who look different. But my children, they're growing up in a city, for one, they're growing up in a city that's very, you know, diverse, and their friends and their people they come into contact with are, I guess, they're middle class. And so they're not coming into contact with people who see them or are being told that they're at fault for their pain in any way, you know. So the people they meet are people that are doing quite well too. I've done quite well in society. So I think it's a class thing for me more than a race thing, for why my children are able to feel much more comfortably English. And as for myself, I feel more English now, more British now than I did when I was growing up. But I think that's because I'm a middle-class writer. I'm not that young kid growing up in that kind of that difficult environment any longer. And I think it says a lot about the power of class and how much class still does rule the outcomes of people's lives in the society. And in the UK, at least, class isn't something we talk about anywhere near as much as we talk about other kinds of things, whether that's race or gender or sexuality. Class seems to be an identity that goes completely unremarked, which I think is really disappointing, because just judging from my own experience, it's the one factor that had the biggest impact on my life.
Yeah, I remember this is a silly story, but when I was in college, I made friends with a British guy and we were just getting to know each other. And at one point he said to me, "So what's your class background? What kind of class is your family from?" And I was so startled. And I went back and said to my roommates, "You know, in England, they just talk about class. It's the most interesting." I just extrapolated. All British people talk about class all the time.
No, but they don't talk about it. They might not talk about it now even, but it's always there. It's always like certain assumptions, unspoken, are constantly being made. Any conversation I have with anyone in the UK, there are certain assumptions about class immediately made just by the way they talk, the accent they talk in, and certain questions about what school you went to. I still sometimes ask what school I went to, as if I'd have gone to some big posh private school. So many of the institutional structures in the UK still uphold ideas of class, and it's just quite an insidious thing, especially because no one actually even talks about it. It's just kind of, it's just there ruling everyone's lives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We read an article about you in The Guardian that says that you didn't read much growing up. You were fascinated by words on ads and packaging, but read your first four novels when you were 18. And I have to say, I'm deeply intrigued by this and wondering, how did it come about that you didn't read a novel until after you were finished with secondary school?
I was asked this when my first novel came out, and I said, I didn't read a book till I was 18. And I said it in just kind of this offhand way, and then it's one of the things that's most sort of mentioned in any sort of profile of me.
Yeah. And, well, given your chosen profession, it's surprising. Yeah. Although going back to Brian Washington, Julie and I had the opportunity to interview him as well. And he also didn't read much growing up. He watched movies and he read cookbooks.
Yeah. There should be a
PhD. maybe we should stop reading all these books, and we'd all be, and other people,
better
people like
novelists.
Julie and me, we'd be better writers if we stopped reading.
I think someone should do a PhD on comparing writers who were avid readers as children and writers who weren't, and see if that bears out in their actual adult fiction in any way. Mm-hmm. But no, it's true. I didn't read. It wasn't a bookish household, and somehow I was in a particular year at school where they decided we weren't going to do any full length novels for our high school. Mm-hmm. We just did kind of anthologies with kind of novel extracts in them. I didn't continue with studying English after the age of 16, or my education in the humanities at all kind of ended there. And then it was only when I was coming to India in the summer of 1999, when I was at the airport and I picked up Midnight Children by Salman Rushdie and started reading that on the plane. And that was the first novel I read. I don't think I understood probably more than 5% of it, because it's such a complex novel, but I kept reading it. And I just remember, I've got a very clear, vivid image of just feeling that this was, a spell was being cast. Something was happening to me as I was reading it. I was feeling different things I hadn't felt before. I had the sense that meaning was being created between me. I suppose I was, as an adolescent, I was always looking for meaning, which is probably connected to ideas of belonging. I didn't really feel like I had a great sense of what was going on with me. And I suppose in reading fiction, the sense that meaning isn't something that is just handed to you, it's something that you create in that particular place between you and the book. And that felt just really, it was like a dam bursting open. And then I just knew I just didn't want to stop. I didn't want to stop reading after that.
That's such a beautiful thought for us to end on. Do you remember the first time you read a book and felt, you know, spells being cast or a dam bursting open and you didn't want to stop reading ever? For me, it was Island of the Blue Dolphins by Scott Odell, about a Native American girl who's left stranded alone on an island for years and years. I remember I read it and I was just like, what? Yeah. Everything about it was so different from my experience. I wanted more and more and more.
Yeah. I remember so clearly the ache of emerging from the world of a book where I had been so thoroughly transported that it felt like that was the place I lived, mm-hmm. you know, and that sense of mourning when the book was over. I felt that way about Little Women. I felt that way about My Side of the Mountain, though I doubt those were the first times. I can't remember the first time.
Did I ever tell you that as a little girl, I wrote a letter to the author of My Side of the Mountain, and I got back a multiple page onion skin paper typewritten letter. I'm sure that the author sent the same thing.
Okay. You can't see me because we're not in the same room, but my mouth is hanging open so wide, I'm almost drooling.
It was crazy. It was single space and it was that fabulous, super thin
paper. We're talking about Jean Craighead George.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. That's so
exciting. I love that so much. I know.
I'm so glad we share that. Do you still have it? Can you show me?
You know, I'm guessing that my mother threw it away. My mom turned my room into her closet. And in fairness, she did say to me, you know, you need to come home and go through all of your stuff. And I didn't. So it's largely my fault. But I also have a love letter from someone in fourth grade that I'll never see again.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, let that be a lesson to our children who are
exactly
no longer leaving, meeting their rooms anymore.
Right.
But I have to say, getting lost in a book the way we're talking about is still one of my favorite feelings in the world, even though it doesn't happen nearly as much now that I'm an adult.
Yeah. For me, that lost feeling tends to happen when I can really sink into a long, fabulous book. Mm. And I think I just need to prioritize those a little more than I do. Anyway, a goal to live by.
Yes,
I think that's it for this episode of the Book Dreams podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe if you haven't already. And if you like the podcast and think someone else would too, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player.
As always, you can reach us at contact@bookdreamspodcast.com. We're also on Twitter and Instagram. You can find more about Sanjeev on the Penguin Random House website.
Many thanks to our producer, Gianfranco Lentini, and to our theme music composer, Maya Polsky. You can find Eve at eveyohallam.com and me at juliesternberg.com. And check out the podcast website, www.bookdreamspodcast.com.
Until next time, happy book dreaming.
Happy book dreaming.
Come listen to Book Dreams with Julie and